From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to wrap up our coverage of this year's Sundance Film Festival with a documentary that explores the way America cares for those suffering from mental illness. And the truth is, we don't care for them in the way they need caring. Not society, not the psychiatric community, not the government. The filmmaker Kenneth Rosenberg is also a psychiatrist, and the story for him is deeply personal. It's called Bedlam. We'll be right back.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're going to tell the story of the mental illness crisis, you have to go to the epicenter of it. And in this country, that's Los Angeles, California. That's where Kenneth Rosenberg centers his documentary called Bedlam, which is premiering at Sundance this year. The film traces the timeline of how we got here to a place where many of the millions of mentally ill Americans are either on the streets, untethered to family or services, or they're warehoused in overcrowded jails. And if you're going to tell the story of the mental illness crisis, it will help if you have the perspective as a doctor who understands mental illness, or if someone in your family suffers. Rosenberg comes at this film with both of those things. His sister had schizophrenia. In fact, it's the thing that made him become a psychiatrist. Now he's also a filmmaker because he wanted to tell her story. Today in the program, we're back in Park City to wrap up our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're in the studios of community radio station KPCW to talk about Ken Rosenberg's film. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg directed, wrote, and produced the film. Again, it's called Bedlam, along with producer and writer Peter Miller. They're both joining us here, and we'll give you some details about the screenings of the film a little bit later in the program. But gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Ken, I wanted to begin with you. You describe your sister as your first best friend.
Right.
Let's start with that relationship. There were signs when she was young that she had mental illness. Talk a little bit about your relationship with her.
Sure. I was very, very close. She was 6 years older than me. I had two sisters, 6 and 12 years older than me. And we were very, very close and loving family and nurturing as can be. My sister also had anxieties and depressions and, much more than anyone else would have. My older sister, Gail, and myself, we had anxieties and fears, but didn't disable us the way hers did and prevented her from going to school, preventing her from having friends. Her first and last long-term relationship occurred when she was 19 years old. She got married and that marriage was annulled within a year. Again, that being the first and last relationship. Yeah. And she was indeed my first and best friend. She would, we watched Carol Burnett's I'm 62, so that was our show. And at nighttime, she would entertain me and regale me with Carol Burnett impersonations. And the song of the day was Sunny, and we would sing. I was a guitar and piano player, so I would play that and she would join along. But the song when she was teenage angst was turning into a young adult psychosis. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it was more like Eric Clapton's Crossroads, where it was, those kind of frenetic guitar licks that, you could really feel the craziness of. And I certainly felt the craziness in our family. When she became sick, and it was apparent that she was psychotic, she was taken to the hospital by my sister Gail and her husband Bob. And my parents were aghast at that and pretty promptly took her out of the psychiatric hospital.
Yeah. Let me play that moment, actually, from the film. This is, as you say, your sister, she gets sick and she ends up with your brother-in-law and your sister. And you are with Bob, your brother-in-law, at this moment, going to the mental hospital where she went. Is that right?
Actually, I was with my parents, and I was, you know, a 14-year-old kid in middle school.
Yeah.
She had been sleeping over my older sister's home with Bob, and I heard that my sister had been taken to a psychiatric hospital or some hospital. I had no idea what.
Yeah.
So I don't remember much about that. What I do remember is driving up to the hospital and my parents' reaction.
My parents drove here, I guess, the next day, and my mother was in the car crying and wondering why the hell they had taken Meryl to the hospital and going back and forth. My father was fuming. He was not very happy that you had taken her to the hospital.
No, not at all.
And Gail and I were besides ourselves. It was so clear that Meryl was out of her mind.
Now, your father thought he was doing the right thing, you said, but
yeah.
He took her out of the hospital against medical advice. You mentioned this in the film. But you also say this, that was the moment you decided to become a psychiatrist?
Clearly. You know, the psychiatrist, we had a couple family therapy sessions. I don't think the psychiatrist did a great job in retrospect. You know, he was a Freudian psychiatrist. They believed that the origin of all mental disorders was psychosexual maldevelopment. So in this crisis, when my sister was psychotic and my mother was crying beyond belief and my sister was crying beyond belief and my older sister Gail and I were trying to kind of keep our heads above water here and get everyone to be reasonable. But in that moment, the psychiatrist started asking my parents in the family session about their sex lives. They didn't really want to be in the psychiatric hospital at all, but that kind of was the deal breaker. So my father, you know, I think reasonably said, this is crazy. This is insane. The lunatics have run the asylum. Our 14-year-old son and our 25, 26-year-old daughter are running the show, and that's got to stop. And he took Meryl out of the hospital.
What was it about what you were seeing that made you want to be a psychiatrist? Just that it didn't seem right? This didn't seem the way to deal with this? Was that part of it?
It didn't seem right, didn't seem the way to deal with it was perhaps the understatement of the moment.
Yeah.
This was, you know, I think it was, I clearly saw the insanity of this.
Yeah.
And it was at that moment that I saw the insanity of my family's denial of Meryl's lifelong problems and their just dreadful ways of dealing with it. I also saw that the psychiatrist knew what the heck was going on in the room. He was able to understand this. He may have asked the wrong questions. He may have been a victim of his Freudian training, which is good, by the way, but not with an acutely psychotic person, their family. But I realized that this man had an understanding of the world and of my world. So I wanted to enlist in his army.
Wow. So that's when you decided to become a psychiatrist.
14.
14. What was the moment, if there was a moment, maybe it didn't quite work this way, but when you decided to become a filmmaker too?
Perhaps living in a chaotic family, part of my relief was to pretend I was making films.
Wow.
So I would come home. I was a chubby little kid, couldn't play baseball, kind of a bit of a nerd, and I would imagine and write films in my head and documentaries in my street and all that, which is kind of ironic because then 50 years later, I go and make a documentary in my home and in my street. But I imagined that quite a bit and didn't do much about it. I was, you know, very determined to be a psychiatrist, pre-med all the way, studied psychology in college. And finally was able to, you know, leave the house after much, much challenge and went to college in Boston and then medical school in New York. But medical school did not seem like psychiatry. It was really quite boring for me. Parasitology, all important things to learn if you want to be an internist. If you want to be a psychiatrist, didn't hold much interest for me. So I was going to cut up a rat brain that summer off from medical school for a summer off, and decided to do something completely different and took a filmmaking course and realized that this was much more like psychiatry than anything I was learning in medical school. Learning people's stories, being able to tell their stories, getting to the truth of the matter, forming relationships. And then through medical school, studied filmmaking. Long story short, I did a fellowship at Cornell where I was, and it was half sponsored by a foundation to promote the use of film. Then right after my fellowship and residency, I did four films for HBO
yeah.
while being a psychiatrist. Because
yeah.
I love being a psychiatrist. I didn't want to, you know, when I told my mother I want to be a filmmaker, she said, go become a radiologist.
Yeah.
So I don't want to abandon medicine, but I wanted to incorporate filmmaking into it.
At what point for you did you start thinking about making some kind of film about mental illness? When did you start thinking about this? Because this has been in the works for a while now.
Yeah. Well, but as soon as I got a camera, so that was the first filmmaking course I took with a big old camera, you know, of that time, you know, what is that, early 1980s? The first filmmaking course I took, it was called Facts and Figures About Schizophrenia. So, you know, that's what held my interest, to make a film about something that I could relate to and something where I thought hopefully in some way I could do some small bit of good.
Peter Miller, let me involve you into the conversation now. What was the conversation like that you had with Ken about what you wanted to do with this film and these ideas?
Ken is an astonishingly wonderful, complicated, and interesting person. He's a filmmaker and a psychiatrist. And he had spent 5 years in the emergency room in Los Angeles tracing the stories of people in crisis and watching how our broken system was not serving the most vulnerable people in the country, and has been thinking about this issue his entire life and knows a tremendous amount. And so we had a challenge. When I met Ken, he had all this magnificent footage and the context and the story of how we got there. And then on top of it all, he started talking about his own family's experience. Mm-hmm. And so we started talking about the movie that we wanted to craft out of all of this stuff. And
did you think that your personal experience would be part of that at the time?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I had been working on the film and then edited in a home I go to in Martha's Vineyard and just kind of locked myself in that home and decided that I was going to put myself in. It was kind of an experiment.
Yeah.
And that experiment succeeded. So I had been thinking about it. And then when ITVS came on board and Peter came on board, we had this wonderful producer, Shauna Swanson, and we all sat down, the three of us. And Shauna and Peter said, you know, tell us more about the story. Because, of course, I had been kind of considering that and working this idea of putting my narration and putting my story in just a little bit like putting your toe in the water. But then with Peter and Shauna's just invaluable yeah. help and support and guidance, I was able to really kind of take the deep dive.
Keep going. I cut you off there.
So as we realize that Ken's story is an essential part of the storytelling and is a framing device for getting us through this longer story, we also realize that we need to connect his personal story, the story of the patients and the families he'd been following, and the broader historical context of all of this. And so we have these puzzle pieces to put together. And the great joy of documentary filmmaking is that after you shoot all this stuff, you then go into an editing room and you sit in the dark for months and months and months trying to puzzle it all together. And it was a creative process working with our editor, Jim Crickey, saying, okay, how do we introduce Ken's story? How do we develop it? And how do we use that as an opportunity to delve into the shutting down of the asylums, to the deinstitutionalization, which led to homelessness and criminalization of the mentally ill, so that the largest mental hospitals in our country right now are our three biggest jails,
yeah.
so that we have hundreds of thousands of people living on the street who have mental illness and need to be cared for. But all of this is then framed as a movie with Ken as our gentle guide taking us through it and also revealing truths about his own family that were painful but necessary and really helpful in bringing the story to a mainstream audience.
Let's talk about the historical context. I like this part of the film. You mentioned 600 years ago, the first mental institution built in Bethlehem, England. This is where we get Bedlam, the title of the film, and this was the general idea. You say in the film that the institutions that were built after that were built as monuments to enlightenment.
Only to become symbols of
neglect. Yeah. Start with the enlightenment part. What was the idea at first, those institutions?
Very, very important idea because, you know, we sometimes think there's a brick and mortar solution to this. And we could just build a building or, for that matter, tear down a building and we're done. And that's so not true. So, it was part of a movement in the 1800s and of compassionate care, often had a religious perspective, a Quaker perspective in this country. Mm. First hospital that my sister was taken to, which we spoke about 20 minutes ago, and the first hospital in America was the Pennsylvania Institute for the Insane in Philadelphia. And that was built with the idea of compassionate care. And the asylums in general, they were built with the idea that the state would take care of, the seriously mentally ill. So that was what went into it. Whenever these hospitals were built, no one said, we're just going to build a warehouse or an almshouse. They were started with the best of intentions. Lo and behold, they were not funded properly. The treatment has always been inadequate. Mm-hmm. People have not been cared for properly in and out of the asylums. And so they fell into, they're terrible places. In fact, there was a 1946 Life magazine article that talked about one of the hospitals near where I grew up, Byberry Hospital, and called it Bedlam.
Yeah.
So the idea that these hospitals were just wonderful places in the beginning and terrible places, and President Kennedy's well-meaning but naive idea, we just got to knock down the hospitals and everything's going to be okay. The community is going to welcome these people into their open arms with the warmth of the community. Great idea. Did not come to pass that way.
At all. So Kennedy's vision was what? What did he have in mind?
He had in mind, Kennedy was a very complicated person. He was influenced certainly by Rosemary Kennedy, his sister's mental illness, mental retardation and mental illness, his sister's lobotomy, which led her to be institutionalized for the rest of her life. And he was also, a compassionate man who saw that the medicines, Thorazines, Haldols, these medicines of the 1950s enabled people to leave the asylums for the first time. So he thought, we could get rid of these terrible places. We have new treatments. We have a new era, an era of compassion and care. Let's build community mental health centers, which he did, a handful of them, not the full gamut. And this will be a plan. And it's a great plan, honestly. Community mental health is a great plan. There are two problems with it. One is you can't put everyone in a community mental health center. Some people are really sick and need to be institutionalized for life. The second problem is what happens when President Nixon or Reagan comes along and says, nah, this is a waste of time, waste of money. Then what do we do?
Yeah. Because the states didn't – I mean the feds didn't want to be in charge. So they want the states to be back in charge, as
right.
you describe. The states didn't really want it. And that's kind of where we are right now, it seems.
Kind of where we are now. I think that we have new there's a kind of a new awareness. I think that – this is a great time, a great window in activism, in people understanding that things need to change. In California, we just elected a governor, Gavin Newsom, who's featured in the film mm-hmm. as a young lieutenant governor. Yeah. And, I think that in New York, we have a great administration, Bill de Blasio and his wife, Charlene McCrae. These people are really taking mental illness seriously. And they're trying to do a lot of things, which we could talk about in detail. But so it's not precisely where we're at. I think we're at a time when things are shifting. But that shift needs to be sustained, because just like President Kennedy came up with this great idea, really was a great idea, it just wasn't sustained because there weren't people coming out and saying, this is my problem. President Kennedy didn't even say, this is my problem.
Right.
So, when the administration changed, the funding dried up.
So deinstitutionalization gets us to fast forward Los Angeles. Tell us why Los Angeles was the place. As we mentioned, this is the epicenter.
Right. So in Los Angeles, the largest, and it's why I went to Los Angeles, the largest mental institution in this country at that time was the county jail. In fact, the three largest mental institutions in this country are the three largest jails. The largest collection of people outdoors who are mentally ill is in Skid Row in Venice Beach. And the busiest emergency room in the country is at the county hospital. That's where we had to go, because that's where I felt with our co-producers, Joan Churchill and Alan Barker, and our camera crew as well, that that's where we had to capture this story.
Talk a little bit about the atmosphere that you convey. It seems chaotic and a little frightful at times, and it's just a cacophony, it seems. And that's actually part of the sort of a theme in the film in some ways, just whether or not this kind of atmosphere is manageable for the caregivers themselves as well as the people experiencing it.
Yes, I don't want to give a spoiler alert, but that you learn about that, how manageable or unmanageable it is in the film. So to give you a sense of it, I mean, I think that's what emergency rooms are, but particularly this emergency room, because you have desperate people living on the street without medication or stopping taking their medication. They have multiple problems. The substance abuse is a common problem. Maybe certainly in upwards of 50% of patients arrive there under the influence. They self-medicate on the streets. It is now a crime to be mentally ill, insofar as mental ill are criminalized, mm-hmm. meaning they end up in and out of jails, so they become like criminals, live criminal lives. So you have all those problems intermingling with a system that really doesn't know what to do with them, frankly. You know, I mean, that's not quite true and fair to the doctors, but they give them a cocktail. They put them to sleep. They have an ER that runs at 200% of capacity. They will need beds. They might take up to several days, in some cases several weeks, to find a bed for a psychotic person. You know, it's quite a mess, isn't it?
Yeah. I want to talk about some of the character studies that you use in the film, mm-hmm. the stories that really illustrate what we're talking about. Talk a little bit about how you went about finding them and telling the stories. Were they just people you encountered there at the ER?
Yeah, we had a very complicated process. So the idea was when I was there in the emergency room, I live in New York, would come to Los Angeles for days to weeks and hang out there, that we would have the hospital identify people who were willing to be in. It was very, very important that I didn't meet them first and say, hey, do you want to be in the film? Because then they might confuse me with their doctor. In fact, often I didn't meet the folks who were in the film until 6 months to a year afterwards.
Wow.
So we had, you know, it's a very important to, you know, do this in the proper way. So yeah. We would have the hospital ask the healthcare provider, a healthcare provider would sign off and say it's a good idea. Of course, the patient would agree. And then we would, film people, and we film a whole bunch of them. And from those people, we decided who we would follow, essentially based on who we thought would, you know, be able to tell an important story. Part of that process was not just to film them and put them on TV, but to talk to them, to get to know them, to talk to their families, to ask them over and over again, year after year, about this process, and to really collaborate with them. I like to say, and I believe it's true, that this was not a film about people. It's a film with these people,
yeah.
which is a very important idea, because in the mental health field, we often talk about patients. We often come up with ideas for patients. It's very hierarchical, honestly. You know, we often don't include the patients and the families in the conversations. You'll see that throughout the mental health industry. I felt that, you know, I wanted to make this film with the families, not just with the patients, with the families, and with them over time, so they could tell us their stories.
I think the idea of over time is important. It's one of the things that I really liked about the storytelling, was that we would see some of these people, and then next year we see them again, and then
right.
next year we see them again. And I think seeing the sort of holistic part of their lives explained a lot, just seeing the way they change or don't change or revert back to, you know, ideas yeah. that you thought they were past. I mean, that seems to tell in of itself the story of mental illness in this country.
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned in medical school, you know, and it's the beauty of film, right? Because you could film someone over the course of months, years, and tell the story of their lives, of their illness that they're struggling with, of their families. And you can see how that progresses. In fact, that's really kind of what led me to study film, that I would see these interviews that the psychiatrists would do in our classes. And always the psychiatrist is on the right and the patient is on the left. The psychiatrist was a guy, usually a white guy, dressed in a suit, and the patient was in pajamas and looked quite disheveled. And that was supposed to give us a sense of what it meant to be a patient. It really didn't. So what the first things I did when I could is I went to patients' homes and filmed them with their families and tried to get a sense of their humanity. So over time, you get a sense of their humanity. You get a sense of what it really means to be sick, and importantly, what it means to be well. And that helps you realize who these people are, not just objectify them as diseases, but understand them as people with diseases, people with families, people with love and good intentions. And you don't get that by just getting a glimpse of them yelling in the emergency room.
No, but I want to ask you about the yelling in the emergency room part, because I think that say something about the various scenes of some of these people who are in states of distress or psychosis. I mean, how did you want to handle that? Because I have to say, I think it's important to see it.
Yeah.
But you want to be sensitive about
Absolutely.
It. And you want to see a fuller picture. You don't want to just see someone raving.
Nope.
You want to see it in context, but it's important to see it. So talk about how, and Peter, maybe you too on this, how you both were or all were thinking about this.
Yeah, well, when I was in the emergency room, again, we had these really gifted co-producers there and cinematographers, Alan Barker and Joan Churchill, legendary cinematographer Joan Churchill. You know, Joan was brilliant at being super sensitive to these situations. And just like the overarching theme was to collaborate with the patients and the doctors in the telling the story, moment to moment, we wanted to collaborate. So we didn't want, if we saw we were doing anything to create stress or create something bad for the patient, we didn't want to do that. And Joan actually wrote a wonderful piece in, I think it was American Cinematographer or IndieWire, in which she talked about this. And Joan used a very small camera. And part of the advantage of that is that she was able to keep eye contact with the patient and kind of keep in touch with them and their humanity. That was the approach we took at every step of the way.
Yeah, the normal documentary camera person has a camera on their shoulder. So the subject is looking at this big machine.
Yeah.
Joan is a very personable soul who's got a camera at her waist and she's making contact, and that results in personal connections. In filmmaking, we should follow the same rules that doctors do, which is the first rule is do no harm.
Yeah.
You know, and then going beyond that, we are human beings first and filmmakers way second.
Well, gosh, some of those moments were kind of troubling in some ways to see, but also deeply honest.
Yes. And we need to do that. I mean, our job, I'm not there as a doctor in any way, shape or form.
Yep.
I'm there as a journalist. Yep. I'm not licensed to practice in California. I couldn't prescribe a pill if I wanted to. So we do have a responsibility to show the truth. As Peter was saying so eloquently, we also have a responsibility to do it in a very caring, sensitive way.
Let's talk about one of the storylines in the film. Tell us about Monty.
So Monty was one of the many people we found in the emergency room. He was being cared for by actually a friend who was a nurse in the hospital, Robin. And, we filmed him in the same protocol we did everyone else. And then afterwards we filmed him. I saw his footage and, called Robin, who we get everyone's number, obviously, so we could follow up. Because sometimes it's indeed very, very hard to find the patients. Many of them are homeless. Mm-hmm. They have phones, which change every 2 weeks. On my cell phone, I have patients' names of these folks I followed and maybe 10 cell phones for them. But we called Robin. I said, "Hey, Robin, I think Monty is a great person to follow. Obviously a really loving man who conveys so much about the illness, but also about humanity. And would it be okay if, we talked to his family?" She said, "Well, I'll ask." And turned out that I met his sister and his mother. We had a lot of conversations, dinners, and said, how you want to do this? Do you want to go forward? Do you want to be in the film? And obviously they did. And as it turned out, his sister, about a year or two into the filming, founded this very important organization called Black Lives Matter. God, this is maybe a tangent. But when I was in middle school, I saw Bruce Springsteen. He was like the warm-up act for Aztec Two-Step in Philadelphia. And they said, "Here's Bruce Springsteen." And, no one knew him. And but I stayed to see him for two sets. And I thought, this guy is great. And who knows if anything will come of him, but at least I'm seeing him tonight.
Yep.
And, Patrice Cullors is like that.
You
met her and we knew instantly that, geez, this woman is brilliant and warm and her heart is as big as her brain, which is highly unusual. She just had it all. And it wasn't a surprise that she became one of the leading advocates in the world. But that was not our intention. That's not why we found her. We found Monty, and Monty led us to her.
Let me play a moment. We'll hear Patrice here. She talks about how the system doesn't know how to properly deal with mentally ill patients.
I had no idea about mental illness. My mother had no clue. If you've ever, you know, dealt with anyone who has any sort of psychosis, there's lots of fear. And so there was one moment when he was in prison where they had to do a cell extraction, which literally means take somebody out their cell. But how they do cell extractions are just horrendous. He was too scared. And so they started tear gassing him and macing him. And I mean, that I just think that's what you do to enemy combatants, not people who are citizens of your country.
And in jail, how was he treated?
Oh, terribly.
We'll talk about that, because this is another one of those strands in the story. We don't seem to know how to make the distinction between a person who's mentally ill and who is a criminal. Would you talk a little bit about this part?
Yes, I think that I would say that we've criminalized mentally ill. What other disease, and this is something Patrice talks about, so I'm really quoting her and her crew, what other disease is there where the police are the first responders? You know, if you're having a cardiac event or you have a reoccurrence of your cancer, you don't call the police. And in this country, we call the police, and the police often are not trained, which is why at least 25% of people who are shot by the police, fatally shot, are seriously mentally ill, and exponentially so for people of color, right?
Yeah.
So that's what happens when, you know, someone's sick. You call the police and you say, take care of them. And the police don't know what the heck to do, so they take them to emergency rooms, and they prefer actually to take them to jails if they can. Because in a jail, they could drop them off in a, you know, central booking or situation, they could drop them off. In an emergency, they have to wait for hours, and I think the estimate is about 25% of police time in this country. It has to do with dropping off and picking up people who have serious mental illness.
Wow.
So, you know, and for Monty, who is just this big, wonderful man, you know, if he's psychotic and he's an African-American man, the police don't treat him the way they should, shall we say.
Yeah.
So that's why he has been, according to Patrice, and I believe it, you know, tortured in jail and, you know, treated in all kinds of ways. He was diagnosed in jail. And what often happens to people of color is that they go to jail versus a ER or a mental institution. So that's quite tragic, if you ask me.
There's another element that Patrice brings up I wanted to ask you about, because it seems like it resonates with your own personal story. She talks about shame. Mm. Let me play a moment here, because she says, as you hear, she says, shame is dangerous.
My mom didn't want to tell people about my brother's mental illness at first. She didn't. I think there's a lot of shame in Black communities in particular around mental illness. Shame is dangerous because shame makes you hide things. And when we hide things, we don't get the support we need. And when we hide things, we're not as honest and transparent about our needs. And I think that shame literally kills people. Shame kills our possibilities of having something different.
That's such a brilliant insight, I have to say.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, Patrice is brilliant. I mean, obviously, right? And she's so warm. You know, you could – and the genius of Patrice is she says what you're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, that was, of course, an experience. And I'll never forget that interview. We sat on the step. Monty had just come home from a hospital, and they were having a welcome home barbecue, which, of course, is, you know, just speaks volumes as to their – acceptance. They invite people to a barbecue because Monty's coming home from the hospital. In my family, when my sister came home from the hospital, it was, you know, how are we going to keep this a secret? And in most families, I might add. So, yeah.
when your sister jumped out of a second-story window,
yep,
broke every bone in her body,
yep,
the family, your family developed a story to tell, yeah, which wasn't the right story. And it, this seems to get at the question of shame, and yeah, right?
Yeah. I mean, what happened is that my sister, I was my first year in college and stayed home to go to college in Philadelphia for those 2 years. Largely to help take care of her. I mean, it also was a good place for me to be. But really to help take care of Meryl after that jump. But when, you know, once after that jump happened and she was in the hospital and taken home, I remember my father had a carpenter who worked in his meat business come to the house to do some repairs. And the carpenter said, you know, I really hope they catch that man. I was like, what man are you talking about? And he said, you know, the guy who intruded and came to get your sister in the house. And so I honestly never asked my parents about it because it was such a crazy idea. I know really where to begin. But apparently they concocted this story that an intruder came into the house and was going to attack her. And she valiantly went out the window to escape. I think what happened is she heard voices and she had delusions and she went out the window not to be brave, not probably to kill herself, but as a kind of, you know, psychotic loss of judgment to maybe appease some psychotic idea in her head.
It's interesting. One of the things that Patrice mentions is that she refused to allow her brother's diagnosis to tell a different story that she already had about her brother.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, because I think that was such a critical point of how you deal with the people close to you and trying to shunt off that sense of shame.
Yeah, it's really important. So you're talking about, and what she's talking about is kind of, you know, not identifying people by their disease.
Right.
So we used to say schizophrenic, terrible way to talk about someone, you know, like defining them by that. And now we say a person with schizophrenia or a person with serious mental illness. So it doesn't completely define them, and that's part of our awareness and our acknowledgement that someone has a disease, and we say publicly, but it's not the essence of who they are. Monty is, I could tell you, I spoke to him just yesterday. He's truly a beautiful person. Ellen Sachs, who I interview in a book I'm doing related to this, is a woman with schizophrenia, but also one of the most brilliant professors, you know, that I've met. She's a law professor at USC. So I think that increasingly we understand that just like people have diabetes, they have cardiac disease, it doesn't define them. This is a brain disease, especially when you're talking about serious mental illness. However you get there, by whatever psychological means, trauma, environmental means, at the end of the day, you know, the brain has taken over. It's an overdrive, and it's driving you off a cliff. It's a biological disease, a biological malfunction of the brain. But that doesn't take away the magnificence of who you are. And I like to think that in the film, for all the characters, even the most aggressive ones, that we see the magnificence of their character.
Ken Rosenberg is with us. He directed the film Bedlam, which is showing in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance this year. Peter Miller is also with us. He helped write and produce the film. There's going to be one more screening for the film. It's tonight at 6 at Redstone Cinemas in Park City. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, where he produced, directed, wrote the film Bedlam, along with producer and writer Peter Miller, who's also with us here. Let's talk about Dr. McGee. There are a few profiles, actually, of some of the caregivers involved in dealing with the mentally ill. Tell us about Dr. McGee.
So Dr. McGee, we found early in our filming in 2012 when we started, and we followed her. And it was clear that she was a star. And she just saw the film for the first time because she didn't want to see it until at the premiere at Sundance. And she spoke with us after it, and she was really quite blown away. But Dr. McGee is this kind of brilliant doctor, sweet soul, wants to do the right thing and finds it, if I may say, by the end of the film, that it's really unmanageable. But she's there for years. She's fighting the good fight. She's having one of the patients we film actually a moment when the patient says, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to kill you." He leaps at her, and we see him being forcibly put in the room, thankfully by the sheriff deputies, because if not, she would have been seriously hurt, if not worse. And it's not very uncommon for emergency room staff to get hurt. I think the statistic is 50% of emergency room staff experience getting hurt at some point in their lives. So if you're longer, if you're there long enough, you're going to get hit. And Dr. McGee fought the good fight. She was there for a long time, but she had an interest in community mental health, interest in public health. And so not only is she a great doctor and a kind soul, but she also became a great voice for the film to understand what people see. So she's kind of like the audience, if you will. She's like an observer who's saying, "I'm here on the front lines." And then she turns to the camera and says, "This is really whacked, isn't this?"
Yes, true. It's interesting. Dr. McGee, like you and like others, have someone close to them who suffers from mental illness.
And like Fuller Torrey, who's in the film.
Exactly.
I mean, this is what happens. It's a labor of love. It's like, my brilliant co-producer, Peter, who does films. I mean, you do this because you love it. Because you can't do anything else. And I think those of us who are psychiatrists, especially those who work with the seriously mentally ill, do it because we love it. And we can't really do anything else. I mean, honestly, I love being a filmmaker. I'm so blessed to be here at Sundance. And again, it's really because of my team, particularly because of Peter Miller, that I'm here. But I would never not want to be a doctor. And don't think I could ever not be a doctor.
Yeah. Well, because in part because of your relationship with your sister. Here's another moment from the film. This is Dr. McGee.
In some ways, I think that's the hardest part of the job. Feeling their pain. I understand how difficult it is. My brother got sick with bipolar disorder pretty much right after I graduated. Putting my brother in the hospital is by far the hardest thing I ever had to do. So I get it now from the other side, what it's like when family members put whoever family member in the hospital and the feelings of guilt and, oh, is this the right thing? And that kind of, I totally get it.
There's an element in the film I want to talk about. You really break down a lot of the structures or the obstacles that have been built up for all of this. And one of them I was fascinated by, and that is how we haven't really budged in terms of treatment.
Right. Well, that's not quite true. I mean, we've budged. We've made some advances, but nowhere the advances we should. I think that you're getting to a very important point, if I may. Yeah.
Right. Yes, that's right. That's what I wanted you to talk about, because this is, there are a few people who express this idea that there isn't a large national initiative or a national project that for research and development of this kind of drugs. And in fact, it's being driven, the motivation is being driven. I'm not sure if it's fair to say it's being one of the motives is money, but pharmaceuticals are the ones that are driving a lot of drug research, where in fact, maybe it ought to also be the government who has maybe a different kind of national priority or motive.
I kind of agree with you more. I think that's perfectly said. I mean, I think we, the people, should demand more. And as we say in the film, to demand more, we have to say we the people. We have to say we are the afflicted, not say it's just the homeless people or it's just some, third cousin in, some other p- part of town, but we have to say this is our problem, this is our family's problem. But to get back to the issue, yes, I think unlike in other diseases, we rely pretty much on the same molecular structures. They are improved, but the same molecular structures, the same research, the same basic pharmaceutical designs that we had 70 years ago. So lithium was developed 1949, thorazine 1949, 1950. We still use lithium as a gold standard for bipolar disorder. Thorazine, we have a slightly, well, no, not slightly, somewhat better drugs which have fewer side effects, but they're not more effective. So we don't have a real advance in the treatment of psychosis, except for we have fewer side effects. But still, the side effects are pretty dreadful. If you see the film, you'll see the people who get treated put on a lot of weight, like 100 pounds of weight. And that's the side effect that occurs in 2019. So we have, you know, we have not gotten where we should be. You know, breast cancer, a terrible disease. HIV, a terrible disease. But we've come so much further in those diseases, but have not in psychiatry, because we're dependent on the pharmaceutical companies. Now, I have to say, I think as industries go, pharmaceutical companies are pretty good. You know, they make things that help people. They also have shareholders. They also are, you know, profit-based.
Yeah.
And if they can make what's called, pardon the expression, a me-too drug, which is kind of better, just slightly better, a little bit tweak of what they had, you know, 10 years ago, they could keep a drug on patent and keep the whole thing going. And it's very expensive to do research. And we shouldn't forget, the brain is infinitely complex, more complex than the heart and even cancer and communicable diseases. But if you add up all the non-communicable diseases, cancer, cardiac disease, and you compare those to the cost burden, the cost on our society of mental illness, what do you think is greater? It's mental illness. But that's not where we put our research and treatment dollars.
Let me play another moment from Dr. McGee, because she says something really important here that I wanted to get you to respond to.
We are still enjoying the gift of Reagan policy back in the 80s. We chose to go from keeping patients institutionalized their whole life to having them live on the streets. For whatever reason, we've decided as a nation that that's acceptable.
That seems like almost the crucial point.
Yeah.
Somehow we have all decided that this is okay.
Right. It's crazy.
And it seems like that's the point, is at some point we've got to start to see this as unacceptable.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone has got to figure this out or be thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. We need maybe a universal health care plan, at least for mental illness, or a one-payer system or something where we're all in the system, where it's not just treating people in the emergency room expensively or treating them in the jail more expensively, because it's not a matter of dollars, it's a matter of where the dollars go. And kind of, you know, early intervention, very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we'd had not a single advance in the treatment of serious mental illness, a single new drug, we know what to do sufficiently. So if we intervene early, we can mitigate a lot of the damage that occurs. Substance abuse, of course, is a big problem and a complicating factor. People self-medicate with street drugs. It exponentially makes the thing worse. It's like, you know, throwing grenades into a fire. I mean, you just, everything really blows up. So, and we have a lot of social ills. Poverty begets mental illness. Mental illness begets poverty. There's a downward cycle. So there are many things that we need to do, but I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's just what she says really captures it. Somehow this has been okay. And in the film, what Peter and I are saying is, nah, this is not okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the ways in which we can address this problem is by recognizing that so many of us in our families have this. This is something that affects millions and millions of Americans, and yet we're silent about it. We don't talk about it. And as Patrice Cullor says in the film, shame kills. If we allow shame and silence to get in the way, we'll never build a movement that will demand changes, demand the research, demand a national priority to address this gigantic crisis that's really tearing apart so many Americans.
Well, I think both of you have mentioned that we shouldn't be waiting for any one administration to step up and solve the problem.
Absolutely not. No, we need sustained a conversation for change. And that conversation has to be continuing. And when people say what to do at the end of it, I mean, I have a long laundry list of what to do, parity bills, where to, what to do if you have a loved one. We have a website, bedlamfilm.com, that elucidates some of those things. But I think the first and most important step that I say to the audience is we need to own it. We need to say that this is our problem and continual. Then we can say, this is our problem. And man, if this is our problem, instead of running away from it, we have to, you know, say this is so not right, you know, and do what people with HIV and breast cancer and other forms of, you know, cancer have done, where they really demand more, where there's a war on cancer, as there was in the 90s. And we see a lot of, you know, a lot of benefits from that. The 90s was also the decade of the brain, for what it's worth. Mm-hmm. But that has not translated in the treatment, partly because the brain's so complicated. I would say partly because there's no groundswell of support. You know, as one of my friends said, you know, where is the milk cartons? You know, where are the ribbons? Where are the marathons? You don't see that for serious mental illness at all.
Ken Rosenberg directed the film Bedlam, which is showing in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance this year. Peter Miller, also with us, helped write and produce the film. One more chance to see it. That's tonight at 6 at Redstone Cinemas in Park City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Ken Rosenberg, Peter Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Renee Bodley, Bob Hendricks, and Ethel Preston here at KPCW. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.